Good evening and welcome to a special broadcast from KBSX News. I'm News Director Scott Graff. Boise State Public Radio recently broadcast a series of four in-depth feature reports on the state of mental health in Idaho. KBSX reporter Emily Ritter-Saunders and Audrey Dutton of the Idaho Statesman spent months researching and reporting the stories. They appeared online, in print, and here on the radio. The stories are archived now at BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. Part of the special series, which we called In Crisis, was an hour-long discussion this past Wednesday evening on Idaho's fragmented mental health care system and what can be done to fix it. This program is a broadcast of that community forum, which was co-moderated by the two reporters. We'll pick up the evening's discussion at the very beginning with Emily Ritter-Saunders.
Over the last few months, Audrey and I have interviewed probably upwards of 75 people around the state. That included mental health professionals. I know some of you in the audience, clinicians, doctors, lawmakers, government agency officials. And while not all of them agree that Idaho has a perfect system on mental health, a lot of people seem to agree that we have a tremendously fragmented mental health system. This is how State Representative Fred Wood put it. I think he summed it up really well.
I mean, we are so hodgepodge and so fragmented. I don't even think you could refer to our current state of affairs in Idaho with respect to mental health and substance use disorder as having any kind of a system.
We also know that Idaho has a shortage of psychiatrists and other providers. We don't have enough money for mental health care for some of our poorest residents. And we know that we have one of the highest suicide rates in the country and a low level of funding overall for mental health care.
We also learned that the state, though, is trying to address some of those things, like opening a crisis center in Idaho Falls, which is expected to open next month, creating regional health boards that are supposed to link people to non-clinical resources, things like transportation or housing. But we have found that many mental health providers in the community are still skeptical that these kinds of changes will have a big enough impact to start to move the needle on the system in Idaho.
So that's why we decided to bring together this panel to talk about some of the challenges, but also look at some possible solutions.
So before we get into some questions, I'd like to introduce you to our panelists and thank them once again for coming this evening. Ross Edmonds is the Division Administrator at the Behavioral Health Division within the State Department of Health and Welfare. That means that he manages the state's children's and adult mental health programs, substance use disorder programs, and the state's two psychiatric hospitals. Ross has a master's in social work, so thank you for coming. Sergeant David Cavanaugh has been with the Boise Police Department since 1994, and in 2007, he launched the department's crisis intervention teams, which work on the front line of mental health care in the Treasure Valley.
Tammy Jones is president and CEO of Idaho Behavioral Health, which is one of Idaho's largest private providers of mental health services for Medicaid patients. She is a licensed clinical social worker and has helped develop mental health policy for Idaho. And Reverend Bill Roscoe is president and CEO of Boise Rescue Mission. He has been since 2002. He has dubbed his approach to mental health care as a biopsychosocial spiritual one. Bill joined the U.S. Army in 1969 and served in Germany and Vietnam and became an ordained minister in 1989. So each of you landed in the mental health profession for a reason, and you've been in it for decades now. What are some of the things that surprised you or some of the things that you did not expect? And how have your expectations changed over the years? Ross, could we start with you?
Thank you. Yeah, I think we all come to this from different angles, and what brings us this profession. Sometimes it's our personal and family histories. Sometimes it's what drives us professionally. I think what's really changed is being an administrator now, that certainly isn't why I got into this work. I got into this work to help people through being a child and family therapist, and that's what I did for several years. And I found it very fulfilling. And then sort of as the years go on and you take new positions, you find yourself further and further away from direct service care. But I reconcile the two by imagining that my sphere of influence over the system grows with each of those things and that I have the ability to affect a larger change as that happens. So when I got into it, I really did care most directly about children and families and delivering care that is helpful to them. I suppose what I've learned over the years because of the position that I'm in now is that not everything we do is helpful. Sometimes we get in the way of helping people, quite honestly, and that like many other things, it's a system that relies heavily and is affected heavily by politics. And I don't mean that in a negative way that we think of. I think of it more as, we need the government to assist the families in doing this. Families can't do this alone. And so anytime you're working with governmental systems, you're dealing with a political system. So I think that's what's really changed for me since for so long ago. Also the evolution of what we call evidence-based practice. It used to be a lot of wonderful people doing a lot of wonderful work that felt good and that seemed to be helping. But really, it's very data-driven now. We have to measure everything we do. We're accountable to a multitude of audiences when it comes to demonstrating the success. And if you boil it down, it's mental illness, similar to other chronic illnesses, is a lifelong struggle for some of the people that deal with it, but the science of it isn't exact, and it's much easier to demonstrate how you are assisting someone that's maybe dealing with a physical illness as opposed to a mental illness. So the struggles that we have there.
And Sergeant Kavanaugh, I know that when you and I talked, you had mentioned, you didn't necessarily get into the police force to be doing mental health care, but you found yourself there. And how have your expectations changed since you've been operating crisis intervention since 2007?
Well, I think all police officers get into law enforcement to help people. That's the underlying reason. And early in my career, I saw that we were dealing more and more with people in crisis. Well, we deal with people in crisis. Like I said, when we talked, people don't usually call to say, hey, I'm having a great evening. Thought I'd invite you over, have a cup of coffee, and I can let you know how great my weekend was. That's usually not why we're called. But the nature of the crisis is as different as everybody who calls. And so what we were seeing is the frustration on the part of officers. We really didn't have a ton of choices. Either we took the person, if they met the criteria, we took them on an emergency mental hold and took them to the hospital. Then the officer would spend 4 to 6 hours in the hospital waiting for the next step to come along for the person to then be taken to a psych hospital or a psych bed. Or if they had committed a serious crime in the process of the crisis, we'd take them to jail. And so now the jail has to deal with the problem of this person in crisis. Or worse yet, they didn't meet either of those requirements, so we'd have to basically leave them how we found them, which is in crisis, but with no real solution. So in 2007, when I was asked to look into the crisis intervention team model, it was a great opportunity to try and pick up that, not only that group that there was nothing for which we could do, but to also catch the people that we deal with earlier, before they actually reach the crisis stage, but when they're approaching crisis, when the officer sees that this person's in a troubled spot and it doesn't really seem to be getting better. So now, instead of waiting for them to reach crisis, we have resources between the Department of Health and Welfare Mobile Crisis, the VA, Idaho Veterans Network, a variety of groups who we can contact to come in and help out. So that collaboration has given us a huge number of additional resources that don't cost the state any money, and so it's not something we have to go through legislature for. So for us, it's been very rewarding, and we've got a lot of success stories over the last several years. And then we're also sharing this across the country, some additional programs that we've developed here. I just presented 2 weeks ago at an international conference and gave away our material to agencies across the country. So stuff that we're developing here is actually becoming really useful across the country as well.
And Tammy Jones, how would you say that your expectations and what you've expected of the career, how has that changed for you since you've been providing services?
Well, I used to think that I was going to be rich by being a mental health provider. And
delusion.
Yeah, that's, now it qualifies as a delusion, exactly. Honestly, I think that the thing that has struck me the most is how bureaucratic it's become instead of it's become about numbers instead of about helping people. And that's, as a mental health provider, that's what really strikes me. So many times we're not able to help the people that we want to help because there just aren't the resources. And there are people out there who need help so badly, and they have no way of getting it. And that's heartbreaking for me. I have about 50 years of experience in the Medicaid and aid for people arena because my mother was a single mom raising 5 kids. And so growing up, I was on food stamps. Growing up, we had a medical card, which is what it was called then, and AFDC, which was aid for dependent children. And I've seen how it's gone from a system that was built in a way that it encouraged people to be self-sufficient and it just helped them along in doing that to a system that now demands that you become dependent on it or you get nothing. And those are the things that really break my heart because so many people out there can't afford to get out of the system because they simply can't afford the help and the medications that they need. And that's, if I had a magic wand and I could fix the world, that's probably one of the first things that I would change.
And Reverend Roscoe, you got into the business of providing people shelter, and mental health is a part of that. Can you talk about how your experiences have changed?
Well, when I started serving in Rescue Mission Ministry 24 years ago, frankly, very few people in that kind of work had any kind of real understanding of mental illness. And it was interesting and it was depressing at the same time because so many people who are homeless suffer from untreated mental illness, and we who were serving them didn't even know that or understand that or have any way to deal with that other than to enforce our policies and procedures. Whether or not the person was able to comply, we assumed everybody could comply, and if they didn't comply, then they were troublemakers, and out they went. And that was kind of the way it was in rescue missions across the land 25, 30 years ago. And then I had the blessing of serving at the Denver Rescue Mission in the early 90s, and I saw that they had a program, a standalone program, a group of services for people with mental illness. And I was stunned and amazed, but the longer I looked at it, the more I looked at it, the more I realized that, aha, this is why Joe keeps coming back again and again and again. And Joe comes and checks in, and he's here for a couple of days, and he does all right, and then he runs out the door screaming, or he hits somebody and runs out the door screaming, and he doesn't come back. We put him on a list, you know, keep Joe out, he hurts people. And I came to understand that mental illness, such as the sergeant said, it's like any other disease, right? And let me say this. I'm no expert on any of this. I warned them when they invited me. I'm not an expert. I'm a rescue mission guy. I see Kathy Garrett back here and others that are way more knowledgeable about these than all of my cohorts. But the thing that I can tell you is that homeless people have an extremely difficult time in the state of Idaho to get any kind of care for mental illness. A difficult, difficult process. And in many, many cases, in fact, most cases, homeless, mentally ill people who are not in treatment have little or no access to any kind of care. And it's a tragic thing because they're the most vulnerable people that you see out here in our community on the street. And if you're a female with severe and persistent mental illness and you're not in treatment and you don't have a support group, you are the most vulnerable person except for the child of that female out there on the street, because there's predators out there. We saw that just yesterday with the tragic death of the man over there on 16th Avenue. There's predators out there, and I don't know anything about the case. I don't know if he was right, wrong, or indifferent, but people with mental illness on the street are extremely vulnerable to violence, to robbery, to harassment, to manipulation, and we see it all the time at the rescue mission when they come through our doors. So just to say that, knowing the things that we've learned over these last 25 years, at Boise Rescue Mission, we have in place a contractor who provides behavioral health care to our guests that we pay for.
And we do that through a grant from United Way of Treasure Valley, who started us out about 6 years ago with a small grant. And today we have a budget of about $45,000, which isn't a lot of money. But we have a 24/7 emergency team that will come to the mission at our request and deal with crisis. They provide group meetings, PSR, psychosocial rehab, medicine management, and simple things like that. And then our staff facilitates the process of the client engaging with the provider, getting them to the appointments, and things like that. And we have seen huge success with the people that have come into that program. So we're always looking and praying for more money, because if we have more money, we can expand the program and we can serve more people in need.
So there are a lot of barriers to care, and we know that. One of the things that was interesting to me while I was reporting this series was the power of stigma, misperceptions, fear of discrimination. It kept a lot of people from seeking care and actually made it harder for some people, I think, to go through recovery. And if you read or heard today's story, then you heard from Shauna Irvin, and she talked about the effect of stigma and judgment.
You are judged. And people don't understand it. But unless you've lived it, you don't understand it. And you are judged.
So whether stigma is a major barrier to care, looking at all of the different things that keep people from getting mental health care, what is one of the most fixable things we could do? Ross Edmonds?
Thank you. That's a difficult question, although it seems so simple to answer. What is one of the most fixable things that we can do? My opinion of people who live with mental illness is that they're often visitors in their own community. They're often observers of the life that goes on in the community and not participants in it. And so one of the things I've thought frequently about and we're trying to do something about is to create in communities. I personally believe that any appropriate successful mental health care is a community response to a person that's struggling with mental health needs, because the community has to accept that person. The community has to include them in as a member of the community. So it certainly is fixable. It's not a simple fix. We still don't, many people still don't consider mental illness for the disease that it is. I think there's still stigma attached to mental illness and, quite honestly, addiction that would suggest that it's a choice that a person isn't strong enough to deal with that. And certainly that isn't the truth. It is a disease, and so acceptance of it as a disease and recognition of the research that exists around the differences in a person's brain is real. And so I think the better job we can do of educating and communicating that will create probably the largest difference that we could possibly hope for. I'll throw in one more thing, and that's the effect of trauma on individuals. We see a lot of trauma. I'm sure that Reverend Roscoe has observed a lot of trauma, and so I think one of the things that we could do to really create a difference is a recognition, first of all, of the trauma that that affects individuals' lives and how what we call trauma-informed care can make a huge difference in their lives.
Tammy, I'd like to hear from you on that, too.
In addressing the stigma issue, I think we have made a lot of progress in that. You wouldn't have had a meeting like this 30 years ago. You just would not. People are starting to understand domestic violence more, and they understand it isn't just why doesn't she leave. It's more why is he doing that, and why aren't we holding him accountable? We are seeing a more understanding of the different aspects of mental health. People now have a better understanding of the differences. You know, not everybody is just crazy anymore. It's, do you have schizophrenia? Do you have bipolar disorder? Do you have major depressive disorder? So I think we've done a good start on educating people. I think what you are doing here is wonderful because people are reading this and people are looking at it. So it's that's the first step. I think one of the things that we could do to enhance mental health services in Idaho is simple but not easy, and that is we need to do the what's now called Medicaid redesign or expanding Medicaid, because that's look at all those heads shaking.
Yeah.
Yes.
Amen.
Yes, because that is going to bring so many more dollars. And what did you hear from us? That we don't have the resources. We just don't have the resources. And then I think also addressing the fragmented system in Idaho, because that is taking away from resources that we can use to help people, because it is so fragmented that it's not an effective and efficient use of the funds that we do have. Also, really helping the taxpayers to understand that if you do cut mental health Medicaid resources, you are not just like, two or three years ago, they cut $35 million out of the budget out of the mental health budget. And I don't know how many legislators I talked to, and I said, but you don't, how can you look at this? Because you aren't just cutting that $35 million, you're also taking away the 70% federal matching funds. And so you basically cut well over $100 million out of the state mental health budget. And that's money that then goes back into the community through people earning it, people spending it, people being taxed on it, which then increases the economy of the state. So I think if we start looking at it isn't just taking money away, it's providing money back into the community, and start understanding that we aren't then spending money in higher cost resources, such as the police officer sitting to my right, because it costs a whole lot more money for his department to deal with somebody who's mentally ill than it costs for my agency to deal with somebody who's mentally ill. And that's what we need to be looking at. We need to be looking at a whole system of care, expanding the types of care that we're able to offer in this state, and understanding that if we take away from mental health services, the mentally ill are not going to go away. They are just going to be utilizing much more higher cost resources, such as the emergency rooms, the jails, the prisons. And it says something when the highest population of mentally ill people in the state of Idaho reside south of town in the correctional institute.
If I could chime in on that, what could we fix that would make a huge difference? The number of beds available is immediately my thinking. Beds for people generally, and then the crisis resource center that's going to be built, I guess, in East Idaho now. There should be one here in this community, and there should be one up north. Those kinds of emergency crisis beds are absolutely essential to beginning to answer the problem. So, you know, intervention's great, and if we can prevent, that's even better. But when we have the person in a crisis and the only place they can go is the jail or to the few beds that at St. Al's, why, it's just you're swimming upstream all the time, and people are in and out, in and out, in and out, and back in their pain and misery. And then the second thing is, I think we need to start thinking about developing like an assisted living facility for families, and particularly families with children, where one or both of the parents has a severe and persistent mental illness. Because we deal with ladies, we deal mostly with single women with children at our ministry, as far as families go. And we see women coming in all the time with 1, 2, 3, 4 children, 5 children, and mom is mentally ill, and she's not in treatment, and she's in denial, or she's refusing treatment because she doesn't want to lose her kids, and the fear factor there of the state taking her children away. If we had a place that we could put that mom and her kids and provide supportive housing to her and those kids, I know a half dozen women that are in this community right now who could live very well in that controlled environment with some support, some accountability, and some help. And those kids could then have an opportunity to be in a stable living environment, and those kids would then do better than they're going to do now with mom bouncing around from place to place in the hospital, out of the hospital. Kids are at the state. Kids are at grandma's. It's a terrible situation. I think that needs to be something we look at hard and long soon.
Since Tammy brought up money, I'll start to go there next. And the state's share of mental health funding has become a smaller part of the overall Idaho Department of Health and Welfare budget over the last few years. And when compared to other states, Idaho's mental health spending is, not at the top. So I want to start with Ross Edmonds, since you're often pitching the budget to lawmakers. You're the guy oftentimes asking for this money from lawmakers. Why do you think there's a reluctance to put money here to invest in mental health programs?
It's a great question. I wish I had the magic to answer that, because I would use that magic. I suppose what I would say is I don't know that there is a reluctance to spending money on mental health care. I think what there is a decision to not prioritize spending. There's so many competing interests out there. There's so many competing needs of Idaho, and it's a decision on what best to do. I certainly wouldn't criticize. I think from my perspective, now really is the time for us to think about how to start increasing those resources. I can tell you without exception, every legislator that I run into has a keen interest in mental health care. They all recognize the impact. They all believe law enforcement when law enforcement says the amount of time that they're spent dealing with those folks. So I guess I would I'm probably not answering it the way that many of you expect, but first and foremost, when I hear Representative Wood say that it's a fragmented system, it just couldn't be any more true. It's so fragmented that we don't even know if we're spending money in the right way to best affect change for people. I think we have to create a system that is the most effective system that we can do and then figure out how to resource it. We need to start by building an effective system, which we don't have right now. We have a Medicaid system which is disconnected from the state-funded system that I run, which is disconnected from the private system that people pay for individually or through their private insurance or the charitable organizations that deliver so much care. It's very disconnected, and it certainly isn't connected to a person's overall health or physical health care. It's pretty disconnected from that, which is another major issue of that siloed effect that occurs in the healthcare system in general, but in particular with behavioral healthcare.
What does it take to start to put those things together and to create that kind of system?
I think we're taking the steps now. Quite honestly, everyone is aware, the Affordable Care Act, however you feel about it, does require individuals to have a benefit. They require individuals to have insurance. Essential Health Benefits Package, as a part of the Affordable Care Act, says that all of those health insurance policies that are on the exchange are required to have mental health and substance use disorders benefits as a part of it. So if that's true, and we expect to see more people with insurance and insurance companies covering with parity to physical health care, mental health care in a more effective manner, I think we're starting to see that. Idaho is working right now to implement something called the SHIP, or the Statewide Healthcare Innovation Plan. And that really is about moving to the next level of complete change in the healthcare delivery system in Idaho. And when I say healthcare, I'm including behavioral healthcare in that. And it's moving to more of a patient-centered medical home approach with the support services wrapped around that primary care model. In my opinion, that is the steps that I have had personal conversations with Representative Wood that he's talking about to get rid of that fragmentation and to make a system out of it, as opposed to having it separated from physical healthcare and having it broken up into pieces.
You talked about everyone being required to have health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Medicaid expansion is a huge issue. A lot of people are talking about it who work in mental health. And we know that a lot of people who are having mental health problems don't have access to Medicaid because it covers mostly children, adults with disabilities, the extremely poor. And there's been the idea that there isn't the political will to expand Medicaid. What do you think it would take for lawmakers to change their tune, or should they? Tammy.
Okay. Well, I would like to go back just a minute to the fragmentation. I think that we've just introduced managed care in Idaho for outpatient mental health services. And I don't know if there's another state out there that has carved out outpatient from inpatient mental health services. And so what that's doing is just bringing about more fragmentation. And I believe that managed care is probably a very good thing. It's difficult. It's not easy, but it is on the right track. But at the same time, we need to not have inpatient mental health services separated from outpatient mental health services, because study after study has shown that it needs to be community-based care. I think both of these gentlemen spoke to that. And if we are separating the funding sources, then we are separating the systems of care, and that needs to change. And so how do we go about doing that? How do we go about expanding Medicaid? I think that while we have done a good job in increasing awareness of mental health, we have not done a good job in taking away stigma for public sector supportive systems such as Medicaid. Instead, especially in our state, we still have a real prejudice against people who are accepting help from the system. And so I think that that's one of the reasons why there's not a political will in this state to expand Medicaid, because if I'm a representative and I depend on votes from my constituents to get me back in, and the loudest voice I hear tells me, well, we shouldn't be helping anybody who's not willing to help themselves, then what am I going to do as a representative? I'm not going to vote to expand Medicaid. So I think one of the areas of stigma that we need to really work hard on taking away is that everybody should just pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. And if they're not doing it, then they're just a leech on the system and a parasite. That's where the real stigma comes in, and that's what we need to be addressing. Because if we don't address that, that's never going to change, especially not in a very conservative state like what we live in.
You've talked about managed care, and I'd like to talk a little bit about, we have been reporting on some of the challenges moving into this managed care system. The contractor that the state is working with is Optum Idaho. We've heard that they've had problems with claims, payments to providers, but some lawmakers and some state officials, including Ross, you've said that, there will be bumps in the road. It's going to take time for these kinds of things to smooth out, but that the change is going to be worth it once we get through those bumps. And Tammy, I'll start with you. If you're confident that the managed care system that the state is heading toward is going to be worth it eventually?
It depends on how it's moved forward. Do I think managed care can be a positive thing? Absolutely. Absolutely, I do. I think that there are going to be bumps in the roads. Anytime that you have a major system change, you're going to have bumps. There are going to be people who fight against change. There are going to be people who are not prepared for it. One of the things that I did to get ready is I have a little booklet on my desk that says 90% of people are not psychologically prepared for change, and these are the major problems that are the major mistakes that they make, and one of them was fighting against the change. You need to understand the change, and you need to look at what do I need to do to change to be successful with this change. So, yes, I think that managed care can and will be successful in Idaho if it's done correctly. If we continue to have this fragmentation, no, it will not be successful, because there is no way that they can do anything but take away from services that are already established right now. They can't cost shift from higher cost services to lower cost services, and we're going to have that in order for managed care to be successful. So the inpatient and outpatient mental health services need to be combined if we want to have success. Is that the plan? I certainly hope so.
Ross, did you want to address anything there?
To respond to your question, I think it was a critical step forward. One of the major initiatives during years of work considering transformation of the system, one of the major elements, or as I've called it, a keystone of change of transformation, is the integration of substance abuse and mental health services into a behavioral health approach. People suffer from both, and we see a lot of it as co-occurring, and with the systems being separated. And so, one of the major components in our quite honestly in the legislature's decision for Idaho to move to a managed care approach, because it was directed by the legislature, was to look at that integration of mental health and substance abuse into a co-occurring system. So I think there's been a lot of steps and very positive steps, and we continue for that to happen into the future.
One of the overarching themes that we've addressed a lot in our reporting is this idea of crisis care versus preventive care. We know that the number of Idahoans accessing mental health care while they're in crisis is growing. We know that mental holds are up, involuntary commitments are up. Anecdotal information from Boise Police Department and from mobile crisis units say that they're getting more phone calls, that they're responding to more of these kinds of crises. So I'll start with Sergeant Kavanaugh. How do you think that we can do a better job of moving away from that crisis care and into preventive care so that you aren't responding, so your officers aren't going to homes anymore?
I think they've basically, the things that have been said over the last 45 minutes all say just exactly that. One of the things that Mr. Edmund mentioned earlier is that the silos. We have too many silos. We have people making decisions because of information they get from one silo, but they don't talk to the rest. So it's very isolated information that's getting to the people who are making the decisions. And again, as I mentioned during our interview, the governor has blue ribbon committees. This would be a really good topic for that. I spoke with a legislator a couple of years ago, and she'd asked me essentially about that, who would be on that committee. We have groups meet every month who would be perfect examples of who should be on those committees. We have county mental health. We have statewide crisis intervention teams. We have a ton of people who are all actively involved in grassroots levels. We try and communicate with each other, but we're having a difficult time affecting a change at a higher level where the funding comes from. So ultimately what now we have is the crisis plan, and the crisis plan is ridiculously expensive and really ineffective. A mental hold can cost $7,000 or $8,000 on the low side, and that does absolutely no good. It's a really expensive Band-Aid. It has no long-term care, no long-term solution. It doesn't get buy-in from the person in crisis. It's really about the least effective thing we have going, but yet we use it constantly. And those increased when the legislature cut back on the budget. We saw an increase in that. So their budget savings just shifted the cost to a lower level. So how do we get out of that? I think that we have to have a group of people who can make recommendations to the legislature, who can then act on those recommendations and not maybe be quite so reactionary to the various things that they react to.
Did you want to address that, Tammy?
I just want to say that for the $7,000 or $8,000 that it takes to do a mental health hold, you can provide a full year of outpatient services for a person instead of the 24 to 72 hours of the mental health hold.
I would add that, and probably everyone in this room is well connected to the support groups and the various agencies that are working to raise awareness on the issue, and certainly you're doing a great job of that with this week-long series. But if we need to recruit our friends and family members to also become supporters of NAMI and different organizations in the community who are really leading the charge from the perspective of the people in crises and educate our neighbors and educate our friends and our coworkers, we write grants for our mental health care program by the dozens every year, and if we get two or three, we feel really blessed. large foundations and foundations that give money for feeding people, for housing people, for taking care of children, for taking care of veterans. That's their niche. That's their bias. Those that want to fund mental health care, and particularly in an agency like ours, we don't have PhDs, working with mentally ill homeless people. We have me and the team that God has brought together there. So it's hard to get funding. But if more people were aware, you know, eventually the news is going to get to people that have the funding that, you know, if you make an investment of $7,000 or $8,000 in an organization that's providing hands-on services to people that are in crisis all the time, it's going to make a huge difference for the whole community. So I think that's something we need to take seriously, all of us. And I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir here, but I know people who have very little information, and I need to get out there and blabbermouth to them. This is how you can help and make a difference.
You all need to do that.
I think now would be a good time, if people want to ask questions of our panelists, to go ahead and raise your hand. And Adam Cotterell with the microphone will come to you. Please tell us who you are.
I'm Karen Clark. I'm with Pioneer Health Services. I'm a CBRS. And I'm hearing a lot of, well, it would be good if we could all connect with one another, but I'm not hearing a lot of ideas about how that's going to happen. And I'm just wondering, well, also there's HIPAA violations where everybody's got to have ROIs, and, you know, so that makes it difficult for everyone to share. I guess in a utopian world where HIPAA wasn't so deeply involved, we might have a computer system where if a client is in Intermountain or and has a PSR agency in another agency where they're seeing a counselor, and maybe they've been homeless for a while, some kind of computer system that we could all share with a single client, driven by a program that's put together by mental health professionals, so that we all know where that person is in that program along that continuum. Is that kind of a question?
Does someone want to address that?
I'll actually tackle that, which is probably kind of strange coming from a police officer. In 2008, after I'd been started with the Crisis Intervention Team program, I'd been doing it for about 2 months, and I realized we need a method by which we can be able to tell an officer at 2 in the morning when they're going to a house or to an address that this person's in crisis, that the person 2 doors down can come and calm them if you need someone to calm them. If they need a place to stay, call their mother at this phone number, and then also a way that we can find out who their primary care provider is, and we can let them know so that first thing in the morning that person has a fax or an email or a voicemail that says, hey, we went to this person's house last night, this is what we found, and so maybe you might want to do a med check or get them back in for a visit or whatever. That was ridiculously difficult to get people to do. And I say February of 2008 because I'm always looking back at that first memo going, how is this happening? Well, thanks to the Department of Health and Welfare, we're actually making some progress on that between them and the 80 County Sheriff's Office Dispatch Center. So we're not getting any personal information. What we're doing is we're starting a process of contacting people who are prone to crisis but talking to them when they're not in crisis, getting them to agree to just give us that basic stuff. I don't care what their diagnosis is. I don't care what their medication is. All I want to know is when you're in crisis, who can we call that can help you? And we're making use of a very rudimentary system, and it's basically picking up the phone, calling the on-call person with mobile crisis, and trying to get the basic information if they have it on this person. And if they don't, then we can also put a little flag and say, let's go back there in a week and see if maybe they're doing better, and we can ask them if they'd like to be a part of that system so that we can respond more effectively with their crisis. So you're right. It's a heck of a challenge. But as far as the collaboration goes, we do have a lot of people who do collaborate on a regular basis. We don't talk specific people, but we do talk about some of the issues so that we're trying to improve our relationships. So that's also been really effective for us. In the past, well, I just came back from a conference where that was an ongoing conversation with law enforcement and mental health professionals couldn't seem to figure out a way to get along to try and work toward that final goal. In this area, we haven't had that trouble. We've been incredibly successful at building that collaboration and partnership.
Hi, I'm Liza Long. I'm a mom of a pretty amazing young man who happens to have a serious mental illness. And I've shared our family story publicly. I want to thank all of you first and foremost for doing this, for having this community conversation tonight, because it's conversations like these that we need to have. It's just got to happen. And then my question is, as I look at the people here, I feel like we're missing one system, and that's education. So my question for you is about the school-to-prison pipeline. For a lot of families in Idaho, including mine, we were only able to access mental health services, some of the services we needed, like PSR, through the criminal justice system. And I just feel like this is really wrong. And I know my story is not unique. I've heard it from several other families. And so I wonder what you'd say about the 79% of our kids who are in the Department of Juvenile Corrections right now who have mental illness. And how can education and our schools play a role in helping us to intervene earlier and to solve this problem before it gets to Reverend Roscoe? Thank you.
Who wants to take that one on?
Is it a you one or is it a me one? I think it's a you one.
Ross?
Okay. Yeah. I'm not sure that I have a great answer to that. I know we collaborate with the education system a lot. I've thought for years, why don't we create something within the education structure? Because that's where kids are. That's where families are. And we've collaborated a lot over the years. I know that one of the challenges that we face in that environment is sort of the different scope of responsibility. You have education, which is focused on academics, and of course the support services to assist a student in being successful academically within that environment, as opposed to a mental health system. And so there's a natural collaboration there, and we're working on it. And I'll, you know, be honest with you, I think right now we're probably on the cusp of creating a system in the children's mental health arena that is likely to be the most successful system that's been seen in Idaho. And education is right at the table with us, recognizing their role in that. So thank you for the question. And I take it more as a comment than anything else, a commentary on what we need to do, because I know that through your experience, we can learn a lot from that experience. So thank you.
Sean Nixon with the Idaho Counseling Association. One of the things that I know of as being a school counselor is that you asked before, how can we prevent this? How can we fix this? One of the things is starting early, identifying people with mental health issues early on. And one of the things was, how do we fix the school system? School counselors. School counselors are trained in mental health and how to assess, diagnose, work with individuals that are having mental health issues. But in the state, we're cutting those positions. The largest district in the state is on record as saying they have not lost a counseling position in the last 10 years with the economic downturn. However, most of those positions have now gone to part-time. So you have a counselor who's seeing 1,200 students and bouncing back and forth between multiple of schools. If we can get what the national recommendation is one school counselor for every 350 kids in Idaho. Those counselors are working with the students on a daily basis, but they're also interacting with the families. So they're there to be the resource. I mean, I dealt with students in the district, but I also dealt with the families that would come in that had hit a wall. They didn't know where to turn. I had the resources to reach out to tell them where to go. That's one of the best solutions that we have right now that we need to start early.
My name is Barbara Kemp, and I've been bouncing around between all of the different Medicaid, Optum, Molina services for almost 20 years for my 24-year-old son, and have experienced the fragmentation and a lot of frustration. There's a lot, sounds like a lot of good problem solving bubbling up. I have two questions. One is, we know where Idaho is right now with this fragmented system. So there's 50 states. I'm figuring there's got to be a model or two or five or 20 of a functioning mental health system. And I'm wondering who's in charge of finding that model and figuring out how to implement it in Idaho and get all these parts moving, and rather than reinventing the wheel. I would love to know if that's being addressed. And then on a personal level, one of my biggest struggles is my son is both developmentally disabled and has now a severe mental illness. I'm sure it is developed from the developmental disability, and yet this would be for you, Ross Edmonds. health and welfare separates developmental disabilities and mental illness. They're separate systems, which is a huge problem. There's a lot of comorbidity. It's not just my son. But those are my two questions. Which state could be a model, and why can't we have developmental and mental health work together as they do in people?
Could someone address the model question? What's a state model?
I think I could, and I guess I would say I belong to a national association of state directors doing the similar thing that I do, and I can tell you from the richest finance state, the richest resource state, that being Vermont, usually in the mental health system, to Idaho and other states in between. We all deal with the same exact problems. We all deal with struggling to meet people's needs. When we go to a meeting, we talk about our challenges and our barriers. It's the same in every state. I would say that there isn't a state that has it figured out. I would say there's some states that are doing a much better job probably than we have been doing in Idaho. And I would also say that when it came time for us to work on drafting a request for proposal, the predecessor to the contract around procurement of a contract that we did for the managed care, which is now a contract held by Optum, we did an exhaustive state review of that. We looked at every state, every single state that has a managed care approach to their behavioral health system and incorporated components of that. So that work is going on. It's just there's pockets of things that work wonderfully in other states. There's programs I could go on and on about, some really wonderful programs. And we have pockets of those things in Idaho too, little pockets of excellence. But it's back to that whole fragmentation thing. It is putting those together. It's putting a fabric across the state that says it doesn't matter if you live in an urban area or if you live in a rural area. How are we going to meet your needs? And figuring out a way to do that. The second component of that, the comorbidity between the developmental disability and mental illness is something that is not new and emerging, but quite honestly, some of the most difficult cases that we work with, we see that. We see that it's individuals talking to my partners over in the Department of Juvenile Corrections. Those are some of the most difficult cases they deal with. And so we are in two separate divisions of the same department, that being the Department of Health and Welfare, and we collaborate a lot on that. Though that collaboration doesn't necessarily trickle down to the ground. It doesn't trickle down to what does it mean when a child has a developmental disability. I mean, many of you know this probably better than I do, but a few years ago, there was one particular service, psychosocial rehabilitation. We now call it CBRS, or community-based rehabilitation services. There was a decision, so the primary effort behind CBRS is skill development. So there was a decision several years ago to say, if you're getting skill development in developmental disabilities, you can't get it on the mental health side. And if you're getting skill development on the mental health side, you can't get it on the developmental disability side. It really was a cutting of that, and that decision was reversed. So there's definitely a recognition. I wish I could sit here today and say that we figured that out. We haven't, but certainly that's at a high priority level for us to figure out a system that can meet the needs of people suffering from developmental disabilities, mental illness, and substance use disorders. So thank you.
And I would just like to add to that a lot of the states that have better programs than we do or more effective programs, it comes back to funding, and if you try to model a program in a state without a lot of funding after a program in a state that is adequately funded, you're setting yourself up for failure. So we're back to the funding issue, and Idaho really does lag behind in funding for mental health services. So
we're going to have time for one more question. Someone in the audience, we'll do one more.
Hi, my name is Julie Schrader, and I've been a psychiatric nurse for about 30 years. Now I'm a psych nurse practitioner here, and I work in the public sector. And I came from Maryland, which is, I think, a better-funded system. And the last job I had was an interesting system that is a collaboration between the city of Baltimore and the state of Maryland. It's a capitated program, and the contract was given to Hopkins Bayview. I worked in this program for about a year and a half before I came out this way. And year one, it was a project when I worked for it. It saved six digits right off the bat. And it still is. Actually, if you Google Creative Alternatives, contact person's name is Sheila Goldscheider, my roommate from college, undergraduate. And it's quite an amazing system. What they do is they serve the most severe and persistent mentally ill, either people that have been in and out of the ER or have been in the state system for decades, and they get them out into the community, provide wraparound case management services, vocational, recovery-based. They have their own bank there. They have a work program. They have recreational therapists there. And we're given an X amount of money for each person, and we're asked to work with that creatively to provide for the person. Now, that amount of money could probably pay for 1 month of hospitalization, but it really worked nicely. And it's still working nicely. The numbers, I was just Googling it last night, and the numbers are still very good. And one of the cool things is that the persons that are enrolled in this program, they're called members too, are enrolled for life. And these people have, they're measured on a whole lot of factors, homelessness, able to keep a job. And it's quite an amazing, it's inspirational. So that was in Maryland, and I don't know if we have the funding. I suspect not.
Is that a program that you all are aware of or heard of something similar?
No, but I would say that one of the major needs in Idaho as we're looking at moving it out of being a fragmented system is to develop an array of services, because right now we have a hammer and a screwdriver, and that's it. The hammer is the mental health hospitals, and the screwdriver is CBRS, and that's all we've got. So we've got to go build a house with a hammer and a screwdriver. And if we can build an array of services, family preservation services, where we send a multidisciplinary team in to a family that has a range of problematic issues, including mental health and behavioral problems. They go in and they work one-on-one with that family in an intensive way for a short period of time, and then move them into a little bit less intensive service, and then move them down. We have had peer supports come into Idaho as part of the Optum package, and I will say that while it is still very, very small portion, it is a great way to graduate people out of CBRS, because there are people out there who don't need that skills training anymore, but they still need the support. And that's one of the things. That's one more service that we now have. We need day treatment. We need family intervention. We need ACT teams that are not just the Department of Health and Welfare ACT teams. We need mobile crisis teams that are public or are private agencies. We need to expand that array of services and take that onus off of the department and into the private sector, so that the department can then do its job of managing and monitoring those services. So if we can look at that as the future of Idaho mental health, increasing the array of services and moving it, privatizing it more and more so that the department can be the manager of those services, I think that we would be a long ways towards defragmenting the system.
I know we could probably stay here and talk for a couple of more hours, but I want to thank everyone for coming. Thank you so much to Ross Edmonds, Sergeant David Cavanaugh, to Tammy Jones, and Reverend Bill Roscoe. It's been great to have you all here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a special broadcast of the recent KBSX and Idaho Statesman Community Forum on Mental Health in Idaho. To hear the in-depth feature reports that made up our series and to see numerous charts and graphs full of data on the topic, just visit our website, boisestatepublicradio.org.